Hello, everybody, and welcome to NPCcast. On today's episode, we talk about traditional games, and as always, we tell you what we are excited about. It is January 17th, 2014, and you're listening to episode 55 of NPCcast.
You are now listening to NPCcast, your place for face-to-face games.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to NPCcast, your place for face-to-face games. My name is Chris, and I'm coming to you from sunny Seattle, Washington. And like I do every single week, I brought a couple of NPCs along for the ride with me. To my left, he is NPC Aaron. Aaron, how are you doing?
I'm full of Indian food.
Is that like a euphemism for something?
No. I just ate a lot of Indian food.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. What'd you have?
I had a bunch of stuff. It's that. it was family style.
Word on the street is it was served family style, and you ordered like four things.
Yeah. It wasn't on my tab, so of course I'm going to do that.
That is the worst. You're the worst human being ever.
I'm a grown man, son. I know what I'm about.
Coming to us from the frozen tundra of the north, he is NPC Del. Del, how are you doing?
I am full of yogurt.
That is also weird. How full of yogurt are you?
I mean, reasonably. I had a yogurt-based dinner.
What did you have for dinner?
Yogurt.
Living that bachelor life, eating yogurt for dinner. Come at me, son.
It's cheap. All right. If you would like to tell us your favorite flavor of Indian food or yogurt, you can do that via social media. You can reach out to us on Twitter. My Twitter is at NPC Chris. Aaron.
At NPC Aaron.
And Del.
NPC DEL.
If you would like to reach out to the show's Twitter, you can tweet at us as well. It is at NPCcast. Of course, we also have a Facebook page. And what is the address for that, Aaron?
It is facebook.com/NPCcast.
It absolutely is. And if you want to send us a nice, long, bulky email, you can do that as well. Our email address is thenpccast@gmail.com. Now, before we get into the actual topic, we have another bit of housekeeping / announcement. Do we not, Aaron?
Yes, we do. You want me to announce it?
I would just say, do we not? And then, yes, we do. I don't know. I asked it really weirdly.
Oh.
Do we not?
We have an announcement. That's what I'm going to agree with. Why did this turn into a who's on first routine?
I don't know.
Third base!
What is that bit of housekeeping, Aaron?
Well, people have hit us up asking about how to donate or if there's anything they can do to monetarily help the show. And now, if you so wish, you can. We have set up a Patreon page over at patreon.com. That's patreon, and it's /npccast. Link will be in the show notes. It's basically crowdfunding, but it's not like a Kickstarter. We're not holding anything hostage. You basically can donate us as a subscription. You get cool free stuff, and we hopefully get to make more and better things because of it.
Right. So, like Aaron said, it's a crowdfunding site. We are treating it as a donate button, basically. A lot of our favorite podcasts have them. We didn't really want to do one. We were kind of thinking for a long time of how we are going to go about being able to accept donations from listeners, and Patreon seemed like a good idea at the time. Our friend Molly Lewis has one, and she speaks nothing but high praise for it. And in fact, if you've been following the RPG news, if you're a member of the blogosphere / Twitter sphere, you may have noticed a very popular game company has also set up a Patreon account. And what game company is that, Aaron?
That is 2013 K's Casty winners, Evil Hat.
Yeah. So they were so proud, so happy to be listed as number one in the casties. They're like, wow, we got to actually use this to our benefit. And they picked that point to springboard into action and set up a Patreon page. So you can check out their Patreon page as well. Link to it in the show notes. Basically, they are promising modules that you can pay for. If you are curious about how Patreon works, you can head over to patreon.com/npccast. We have a little video plus a whole bunch of text there to kind of explain how it works. We're pretty excited about the stuff that we can do with it, and we hope you'll check it out. On that note, we're going to get into the topic of today's show. Now, this actually came to us originally from an email all the way in last year. And we're getting to it now. We had those couple banked episodes at the end of last year, so now we're getting to it. A listener of the show by the name of Baron had asked us about traditional games. And traditional games has sort of a weird connotation, because in a lot of forums across the internet, traditional games are any face-to-face games, board games, card games, tabletop games. They're all under the quote-unquote traditional game sphere, because there's something, and I guess it's pretty popular these days, but video games are a thing. Kids are, they just jack into the internet and they can play on screens or something.
Yeah, I think since Shadowrun is where I get all my information on this, I think they plug directly into their brainstem.
Oh,
and then
okay.
They exist virtually within the game.
Yeah, yeah. So apparently traditional games, so a lot of people mean any sort of face-to-face games, but what do we mean by traditional games, Aaron?
So these games are going to be old games, at least 25 years or more, and they're going to be largely abstract games. But these are basically the games that have stood the test of time: checkers, chess, Go, as well as, you know, cribbage, bridge, like those kind of games. So games that have been around for a long time, and, you know, we want to look at why they've been around and why we shouldn't forget them in the hustle, like, of all these new games constantly coming out.
Right. We have a very adorable group of elderly women that come into this our local game store every week and play bridge. They're here usually before we open, waiting outside, huddled. And they come in and they play bridge. And these are the types of games that, you know, your parents, depending on your age, I guess. Ooh, I don't want to, like, that's kind of mean to some of our listeners. Some of our listeners grew up with these games. And I almost said your parents grew up with these. Depending on your age, you know, either your parents, your grandparents, or you grew up with these games.
I mean, you grew up with these games regardless of whether or not you played them. They've been there, lurking.
Yes. Dell's actually right. That's actually hits a nail on the head. These games have been around forever. You know them if you saw them. So that's what we're going to talk about, is some of these traditional games. So you could call it classic, call it whatever you want, but that's kind of going to be what we're discussing. The first question, of course, Aaron, is if I have all these new games with, like, meeples and wooden cubes
and Takedo cards
and yeah, like slick cards and like D8s. Why do I care about these old games?
The first reason is they have really refined mechanics. These rules aren't largely exception based rules. They're very slick, very streamlined, and that's why they have stood the test of time. I'm sure there were plenty of very complicated, like, weird games that were invented over the years, you know, that we don't talk about because they didn't last like these games have. So playing these games, you really get, like, this experience, like, to experience, like, what the essence of a game is and really see that in action. It's cool.
Yeah, I want to draw the comparison to music, if I can, for a second. And I want you to think of sort of rock music or just popular music from the 70s, 60s, at this point now, even the 80s. You think of these really iconic songs, right? But imagine a world where those songs were just one of thousands of songs that were released during those decades that you would never know growing up now that they even existed, right? Imagine today, if you're listening to the radio, how many of those songs do you think are going to show up on, you know, classic stations in 10, 20 years? That's kind of what we mean with these games having refined mechanics and standing the test of time is that all these other things may have come and fallen by the wayside, but these games that are left are there for a reason. And one of the big things about them is that they have audiences outside of those quote-unquote hobby gamers, right? A lot of these are universal types of experiences because, as Dell pointed out, everyone has grown up around these, right? Like, I've had multiple girlfriends over the course of my life that I've played games like chess with, backgammon, and these are not gamer girls, but it's just something that has always been around. They've always been, you know, in their household growing up and whatnot. What other things can we glean from these traditional games?
You can kind of see a little bit of how games are put together because they have so few moving parts. You can start to understand why pieces move the way they do or why design concepts are there. Also, there's a lot of books about them. There are books about backgammon and about chess and bridge that go into the theory behind them, the theory behind why things work the way they do. It's super neat to have, you know, nobody has written books about Ticket to Ride. It's fun, but there isn't that kind of devotion to it that there is to these ultra classic, ultra important games. Plus, chess is getting added as a summer game. 2016.
You could be an Olympian.
True.
Aaron, what do you think is one of the main highlights of quote-unquote traditional games?
Well, in traditional board games, at least, there is little to no randomness. In chess, what's random is who ends up being white and who ends up being black, which determines first and who goes first. But that's literally the only bit of variance in the whole game. No piece is like, you know, this moves in an L shape, but only if you roll a two or more on the die, then otherwise it moves in this shape. So there's nothing but player skill and that one who goes first factor determining the winner of the game.
Right. And that is actually in... It's coming up. We're talking about my favorite traditional game. There's a little bit of randomness in that one, but we'll get to that when we get there. Dell, what's another advantage of traditional board games, or I guess what's one of the traits that a traditional board game has from a design perspective?
It's you only need two people most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually you're able to get a game in. Because you don't need to get five or six people together. You know, there's a lot of games that break down with only two people in the hobby, whereas two people is the max you can have for chess or for backgammon or go or anything like that.
Right, and I think that a lot of like what you're going to see out of two-player games nowadays, even if you look at like first one that came to my head is a game like Hive. They do stand, you know, on these other games as sort of their foundations in the way that they're designed and play. Usually you have two players and you have completely symmetrical size, except for, you know, of course, white versus black pieces or whatever. But for the most part, the sides are symmetrical as opposed to these, you know, larger multiplayer games that have asymmetrical choices or asymmetrical, you know, nations to play and stuff like that. So really, like, the standard for two-player games is rooted in these traditional classic games that have been around forever. The other thing that's great about them is because of the way that they are designed and because of the fact that they can be played with two players, when you're playing with competent players, you're usually dealing with relatively manageable play times. Now, of course, you get into situations with chess where, you know, games could last hours if it's like two chess masters going, you know, back and forth and sort of,
although they usually use a death clock, so,
well, in yeah, they a lot of chess tournaments will have, you know, at least a chess clock, which is great. So Aaron, what do you think it is about these games that sort of makes them more conducive for shorter games
play time wise? It's the lack of mechanisms. There's only, you know, since it's stripped down, which we've reiterated, there's only so much the game can do. So that without adding layers of complexity, there's a cap to how long the game can take. Most of them are relatively bound within this finite space. And, you know, in checkers, the opponent only has so many pieces to lose. And And same with chess. So once you're down a certain number of pieces, it's inevitable that you're going to get checkmated if you're talking players of equal skill. So because the bounds are so small, it's relatively easy to keep the play times down.
Now, that's interesting, because do you think it has something to do with in general, the options that a player has at any given time? I mean, it's kind of tough because, you know, when you're talking about chess, it's almost, you know, funny to think that there's not a lot of options, because you have, you know, multiple pieces, and there's the decision tree can be very wide, I guess, if you're trying to, you know, plan a few moves ahead. But in general, the options at least are very apparent to both players, and there is that ability to sort of think a little bit ahead and anticipate what your opponents are going to do. Partly because another trait that a lot of these classic games have is the lack of hidden information. You know, we talk about hidden information a lot on the show, because it's one of the things that when I personally am thinking about game design, I like that element in the games that I come up with. But there's not a lot of this hidden information in traditional games. Of course, there are notable standouts, as we will see in a moment. But for the most part, a lot of these abstract strategy games rely on both players kind of seeing the board and seeing everything kind of play out in front of them. There's, of course, exceptions as well. So let's go down the list. We each picked a favorite traditional board game of ours, and we're going to explain why we picked that. Aaron, what is your favorite traditional board game?
This breaks the two-player rule, because it's more than two-player, but I really like Chinese checkers. It's exceptionally easy to teach people. It's unlike checkers, you're not eliminating people's pieces when you jump over them. Everyone is in the game with all of their pieces until the end, which is kind of neat. And it plays six people. I played it a lot when I was a kid with like my grandparents, so it's kind of one of those nostalgia games to me.
What is, if you were going to make a game today, like a modern game, what would you incorporate, or what could you see as a mechanic or a way of thinking that's in Chinese checkers that you think is really brilliant that you would like to see in a game today?
The way that Chinese checkers, in order to make a good move, you can't only use your pieces. So the way you set up chains in that game, being that you have to both be setting up your chain and trying to force your opponent or convince them to move into ways that they don't think are going to help you, but then all of a sudden you leap a piece all the way across the board with them to the other side. It's very clever, and it's like several levels deep for such a simple game, in that you have to be building something, convince your opponent you're not building it, and that thing you're building has to be functional still for you as well. It's really neat.
Yeah, so you kind of have to build it for the future, but also protect against what everyone else is doing at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. So, Del, what did you pick as your favorite traditional board game?
I'm hoping you guys let me count this, but I am picking Stratego, the 1961 board game.
I wasn't going to let you count it. I looked it up. I was like, I don't think Del understands the topic. But then when I Googled it, I was like, all right. It's old enough. I'll allow him to explain this game.
Yeah, and it's actually based on a chess variant from, you know, the 1800s. So it's older than it looks.
Right. So what is it about Stratego that makes it one of your favorite traditional board games?
I like Stratego because it rewards players for being able to remember 15 or 16 different bits of information at the same time, which is something I'm good at. So I have an advantage when playing against people. can't take the spike out. I'm sorry.
Michael Jordan, why is your favorite sport basketball? Because I'm good at it.
the fact that everything is hidden information until it's not, and then having to remember all that is really great. And there is a high-end variant where you just, when you attack a piece, your opponent simply says whether the attack succeeds or fails and doesn't tell you by how much, so you can't know what a piece is even after you defeat it or not. That that adds so much to the, okay, that piece is that, that piece is that, I've eliminated that, that one is, you know, that one's a scout, that one's a mine layer. So there's so many things to keep track of all at once for the duration of the game that it is super attractive to me.
Now, this, again, is one of those things where, you know, in my opinion, it bucks some of those traits that we included in our examples of, you know, the traits that all traditional board games have. When you're thinking of modern game design, Del, what is the element of Shishigo that you think we can glean from when we're looking at games that are come out, you know, in this year, 2014?
I think the awesome takeaway, the thing that Stratego can teach modern designers, is how to make a game that has very simple pieces and piece movement and still have very complex interactions between them. Because other than the scout and the bomb, everything moves the exact same way.
I would agree with that. I mean, one of the things with Stratego, and I guess the element of hidden information in general, is that you instantly get more depth to the game, because now you're not calculating moves necessarily. You're trying to, you know, outthink your opponent, like, with the infinite possibilities, or I guess the non-infinite possibilities that could arise, as opposed to a game where you're seeing everything all at once.
Plus, is there like a greater gaming high than when you take, like, when you risk the gambit of putting your flag like on the front line off to the side, and then like you win and you get to flip it around and show them that they passed right by the flag, and like, oh, that's the best gotcha ever.
Yeah, it's like, you didn't move it. I thought it was a bomb.
Yeah. Nothing is better than that. That's like probably one of my favorite like gaming memories I have, is the first time I risked putting the flag in strategically a kind of stupid place, actually, right, but then like won anyway and got to be like, it was right here.
Yeah, exactly. One of my favorite traditional board games, and I actually may have mentioned it already, is Backgammon. I really like Backgammon a lot. I like how it's very straightforward. It's two players. Now, the thing with Backgammon that appeals to me is there's a couple things, but I like that it has a random element in it. So when I'm playing someone who's never played Backgammon before, they don't always feel like they're going to automatically lose. A lot of times, if you know you have a really good chess player and he's or she is playing chess with someone else who's not very good, you know, you can almost predict the outcome before the game starts. Backgammon at least has that random element that someone who's newer to the game can do well. And there is also obviously a lot of strategy that goes into, you know, formulating the way you play the game. In addition to that, like I said, it's one of those games that I've played with people who are non-gamers before, and they love it. And, you know, you can just jam games of Backgammon in relatively regularly. Now, my favorite element of Backgammon was actually, it was a newer addition to the game. The game has been around for a very long time, but somewhere in the 1920s, they added an element to Backgammon, and it's really for gambling purposes, but it is the idea of the doubling cube. And for the longest time, I always saw this, you know, die that was like 2, 4, 6, 8, or no, it doubles every time, so 2, 4, 8. 16 all the way up to 64, and I was like, what is this die? Like, why, this die is awesome. Like, I want to roll a 64 on a six-sided die. Like, what does it do? And then when I was actually learning about the game of Backgammon and what it actually did, I thought it was really kind of ingenious. And basically what it is during a game of Backgammon, if one player gets ahead, they can basically propose to the other player that the stakes will be doubled. Of course, this is works when you're gambling, right? Like, if me and Aaron are playing and we're, you know, we're paying each other points or whatever.
Or Tarmogoyfs.
Or you're gambling Tarmogoyfs. Kids, don't ever do that. It's a horrible idea. Take it from me. You don't want to fall down that hole. So if you're playing for points or whatever, at any given time, I can say, hey, Aaron, I'm ahead. We're going to double the stakes. And Aaron can say, all right, I agree to that, and the stakes are now doubled. Or he can say, you know what, I'm good, and the game is over, and then I win at the current stakes. To me, it's a very sort of modern game design type thing that is incorporated in this game, or was added to this game in the 1920s because of, you know, gambling houses and stuff. But it's ingenious to me. I love the idea that you can sort of, you can get ahead, and then, you know, the, it's sort of a risk assessment at that point. If you're behind, it's like,
yeah, force your opponent to surrender at the current stakes and not have to keep playing so you can go to the next game. Or, you know, if your opponent thinks he can pull back ahead, you know, then there's egg on your face. It adds a lot of tension. That's really cool.
Yeah, exactly. And it's the type of thing where it's like, you know, in a newer game, if you incorporate that sort of idea in with along with a random element or along with you know, some hidden information or something, it could be a very powerful tool to say, you know, well, we can stop now, but I win and I get this or whatever.
I've never played, nor did I know how to play backgammon, so I was interested in to hear about this. But I always loved that die, and I just thought, man, it'd be cool to design like an RPG that's the conflict resolution die is the doubling cube.
That's how much damage you do.
Yeah,
it's not swingy at all.
1D backgammon.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, I've always, growing up, I played a lot of backgammon with my parents and stuff, and I never knew what that die did until a couple of years ago, actually. But yeah, it's really cool. And that's one of the things that I like about these traditional games is they can exist for, you know, in some cases, thousands of years. And then you're like, you know what? We'll add this element. And it's usually the casinos. They're always the first ones to think of ways to like really, really figure out a way to literally raise the stakes. But you add one element to it, and all of a sudden the experience is, you know, completely different, right? Like having a doubling cube, you know, if you're playing for points, or let's say you're playing a string of matches, it just adds another element to the game that is really, really unique and pretty fun. So there you go. Now there is, speaking of gambling.
Yeah.
There is another type of classic / traditional game that we're going to discuss. And it's really like a whole genre of games. And we sort of set it off to the side when the show notes were set up. What is that, Aaron?
Card games that use the traditional, you know, king, queen, jack.
Playing card deck.
Is that the official name?
Yeah, so they're just called playing cards.
Yeah, so games that use playing cards, they kind of break rules. Obviously, the first one being that there's a ton of variance in card games because what you're dealt is totally random. Could be anything from a two to an ace, and that could, you know, for one, different cards are worth different amounts of different games, so who knows how good each of those things are. But what's crazy about this is that with the same set of components, there is a staggering variety of games that exist.
Yeah.
And I imagine that is partially because is there anything with a lower financial barrier to entry than a deck of cards? So I think you can get a deck of cards in our store for like $3. So
yeah, you can get them for free by going to Vegas and asking. they just hand them out. They have a hole puncher. They punch a hole in them and they can just give you a whole deck.
Yeah. So... obviously, you know, there's a ton of card games, right? And we've already touched on, you know, why they're so kind of unique within the sphere in that, you know, you get a ton of variety from a single deck. They're relatively inexpensive. I mean, the really cool thing is that they're very understandable to anyone. I mean, you can have, there's card games that you can play with people, there's no language barriers, right? Like if someone knows how to play the same card game, they can play it because there's no, it's just numbers, symbols, and colors basically. What else is about card games that makes them so awesome, Aaron?
Well, card games are intriguing to me for their like social aspect, because like every family always has their own card game that they play.
Yeah.
And like when you hang out with other people's families, that's when you learn like new card games. They're like, oh, you've never played this? This is the card game I've been playing since I was little.
Yeah, you never played 727?
Yeah, that's what's so cool about cards, is that you're like, oh no, like literally every family I know played cards at some point, and so many of the games they play are different from different cultures and different growing up on different coasts. You'll see different card games, and that's really awesome. I think that's like a cool social construct built around these kind of games. I'd be interested to see like a map of like where different card games like to come from and stuff. Would be really neat.
Yeah, like someone should do like a poll and be like, what are your favorite card games? And they can like pinpoint what region of the world you're from based on that information or something like that.
Yes.
What else, Del? What else is cool about card games?
You can actually, card games or, you know, having a deck of cards, there's a lot of opportunity to express yourself just in the card deck that you use. You know, it's when you have to keep a deck of cards around because you don't know when a game of spades is going to break out. You know, you have your, you know, do you have a deck full of Star Wars characters? Do you have the U.S. Army Most Wanted list from Iraq deck of cards? So it's the ability to have, and there are some really, really cool decks I've seen where the cards are clear and just have Mylar printing on one side. It's super neat. I love seeing the creativity and the ways to extract money from people that card making companies have come up with, because like we said, you can go to the dollar store and buy, you know, two decks of casino cards for a buck, and yet there's still so many opportunities to spend money on really neat looking cards.
At any given time, if you go to the game section of Kickstarter, there's almost always a cool deck of cards being kickstarted.
Right, and I think that's a testament to the fact that at any given time, you can go to almost any household in the country and they will have a deck of cards somewhere. Like at my parents' house, it's like in the same drawer that they put like Parmesan packets from Pizza Hut and screwdrivers from things that they don't know.
Allen wrenches.
Yeah, it's like here's like the Allen wrench / thumbtack / crushed red pepper / card game / old rubber bands that don't work anymore drawer. Batteries. Old used batteries.
I think it's also neat because they've worked their way into other games. You know, like the playing cards work as a conflict resolution system in some RPGs. Now there's a minis game. Malifaux uses them.
There was a collectible card game called Deadlands, where every card in the game that was a traditional collectible card game also had a number and suit in the corner of the card. And when you fought, you actually fought with poker hands. In the card game.
And now there's also Yomi is a card game where it replicates a fighting game, but every character's deck is also functional as a 52-card playing card deck. So
that's cool.
It's interesting because it's totally better than any other traditional types of games, kind of worked its way into the new games. Like, there's lots of chess variants, too, but I still don't think it's as deeply interwoven as, like, these card games are.
Yeah, and one of the best things about them too is from like a, you know, aspiring game design perspective, is that they're so useful to just test ideas, right? Like, you can come up with an idea for a card game, and because they're readily available and they're cheap and they're already printed on, and you can kind of figure them out, you can really test out a surprising amount actually of game design ideas with just a deck of cards to see how they work out.
This should be a bullet points.
Bullet points, deck of cards?
Yeah, you have to use the traditional deck of cards.
That sounds pretty good.
Yeah, I actually, when I was in a game design league, we put together a party game based on setting up a dream wedding. And we actually used decks of cards to represent, you know, money and time and all that. And it was surprising how much of the game was, how deep the game got just off a deck of cards.
Yeah. Next bullet points. That's what I say.
And if you plan on using decks of cards to do, like, you know, prototypes with, pro tip, buy a couple cheap decks with the same backs, and then always have a couple with different backs, but like the same company or whatever, because you can either double the amount of cards that you have, or you can have two different types of cards in the same deck. It's pretty useful. So
yeah, in our Edge of the Empire game, I'm actually working on a Sabacc variant. That I use two decks of cards mushed together to generate.
Well, there you go.
Sabacc.
So, speaking of card games and everyone having a favorite, what is your gentleman's favorite card game?
You're just trying to one-up me. Every segue, you're just trying to one-up me. And yours are sloppy, sir.
I wasn't trying to one-up you.
You're just trying to up me.
No, I was just trying to contribute to the structure of the show.
Speaking of contributing to structures, my favorite game is Bridge.
Oh, that's how it is done. See, Aaron, you can learn something from Dell. That is how you
Now, at this point in life, I can learn exactly one thing from Dell. Yeah, this is true.
All right, Dell, you've been itching for, I would say, 54 episodes to talk about this game. Tell us about Bridge and why it's your favorite traditional card game.
So I first learned to play Bridge. When I first learned, it was called Spades. We learned it in the mean streets of Miami Shores, hanging out in the back of the class playing Spades rather than listening to the teacher. And it wasn't until I went to visit my Grammy that I found out that Spades was actually a game called Bridge that had been around for hundreds of years. And taking my Spades knowledge and finding out it was directly applicable to Bridge was super awesome. The beauty of Bridge is that there is so much bidding and betting going on that has to happen with these subtle, like, eye flicks and secret tapping on the table with your finger in Morse code to call, seven, no trump, eight, eight diamonds, nine clubs is super, super cool. And playing bridge also gives you that great, great feeling that's the same as playing like a Winter Orb Stasis deck in Magic, where you just present your opponents with no valid options and they just have to play a card that would be a good card any other time, but right now. It's the best feeling when diamonds are trump and you just force them to throw spade after spade after spade that would be good, but not today.
I also don't know how to play Bridge.
Oh, we got to play Bridge sometime.
All right, I'm interested. I was working today and our Bridge Club ladies were in playing Bridge, and I was like trying to listen in. I was like, this game actually sounds super cool. I need to learn. If I wasn't working, I would literally ask to sit down.
I bet those ladies are so good at Bridge.
They'd be like, come on, kid, you can sit in and we'll teach you to play Bridge, and it's like sharks.
Yeah, yeah. The other great thing about Bridge is that all old people play Bridge. So if you ever go to like a senior center, because a court made you and have to spend some time with old people, you can get your service out of the way playing Bridge with them.
Yeah, let's write that down. Hopefully you've been taking notes.
In this situation that we all encounter at one point or another, doing community service at an old folks home for some transgression.
Like you do.
Yeah, like everyone does.
I'm just trying to make my college application look better.
I guess I'll go next with my favorite traditional card game. And that game is known by a lot of different names. In fact, when I looked it up, because I was trying to find the actual name for it just to make sure I had all my facts straight, a lot of names came up, and there are some that were like, I'm pretty sure they're racist, but I don't know. You have to look it up and be the judge. But it's a game that I grew up calling 13. And basically, 13 is a card shedding game where you have you split the deck up into four equal parts. Your goal is to get rid of the 13 cards in your hand before everyone else gets rid of their 13 cards. It uses basically poker hands, with the exception that in 13, twos are higher than everything else, so twos are the top. It goes from three to two. The thing I love about this game, and one of the things that I think is so brilliant about it, from modern sensibilities looking at it from a game design perspective, is that it's not necessarily a catch-up mechanic. I don't really know how you would describe it, but it's the idea that you can be ahead for a long time, but if you don't plan out your moves, eventually you're going to run out of gas, and that person who was losing the entire game is never actually out of it. Because of the way that you're getting rid of cards from your hand, it's possible that you could start off with a deck or with a hand that's not really optimal, doesn't have a lot of power, but you still win because your opponents make a mistake and they don't, maybe they had a straight and they split it into two smaller straights, or they had three of a kind, but for some reason they used it as a pair plus one or something, So there's a lot of different strategies that you can use with it, and there's not really player elimination because of the fact that, you can have one player who might I'll call it combo off, for lack of a better term. You might have one player that's kind of running the table, and all of a sudden they're left to two cards, and they're both singles. They have, like, you know, a four and an eight. And it's like, oh, man, I'm not going to be able to get rid of both of these. And then they end up losing the game because they didn't think ahead and far enough. So
I have never heard of this game, ever.
Really?
I've never heard of this. I heard of a similar game that abbreviates into BS, but I don't think that's the same game.
No, it's very different.
Yeah.
See, I've played 12, and I've played 14. I've even dabbled in some 15, but I've never played 13.
Yeah. Oh, man, you guys got to play. It's super fun. The cool thing about 13, too, and this is, again, sort of in with my sensibilities, is what I really like to do is play 13, but instead of having four people, so there's four even hands, you play with three people, and so there's 13 cards that no one knows what they are, and you have, like, even more hidden information because you're not sure at that point what the best card at any given time is, so... It's pretty neat. But yeah, check it out. From my Wikipedia research, it started off as a game from South Asia. So it was like in Vietnam and stuff like that. And then came over here. And it has a bunch of different names. And check it out. It's pretty fun. But one of the really neat things about traditional card games specifically, even more so than traditional board games, is the fact that there's a lot of like variants on these games. In fact, Aaron, you're going to be up next. But... your game is basically a variant of another game, which has dozens and dozens of variants, right?
Yeah, when I first made the show notes, I picked Hearts because I like that game, but then I realized that I would be lying if I said anything other than Texas Hold'em was my favorite card game.
Right.
And Texas Hold'em is a certain style of poker. It's the style that is easily the most famous now. It's the style they play on TV for the World Series of Poker and all that.
Historical note, it was neither invented in Texas nor in use back in the 1800s in all the cowboy and Old West movies that it appears in nowadays.
Yeah.
Does it appear in cowboy movies nowadays? Because every cowboy movie I've ever seen, they're always playing it like stud poker.
Yeah, usually they're playing 7-card stud or 5-card stud. Sometimes 5-card draw.
I don't know. We have to have a Maverick watching party.
Oh, he plays. They play draw in Maverick.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great movie, though. Anyway, so I love Texas Hold'em. I think for me, the clear reason I love it is because poker allows you to mitigate the variance of a card game by playing the player instead of the game. With all the bluffing and reading of tells, what is in your hand is actually like the least important part of the game. It's still very important because you got to calculate odds and whatnot and know what your outs are and all that. But it's very fun. And one thing I like and hate about Texas Hold'em is that when you're good at it, you tend to lose to not good people because the subpar plays are what are hard to keep your mind around.
Yeah, playing against people are like, I'll just go all in. What am I? Was this Jack 10 off? That'll clear. And it's like, oh! And then it does.
The one that infuriates me more than anything, and I laugh about it now, is when I have something like pocket kings or pocket aces, and I bet very aggressively, and someone stays in, and I'm really confused because there's no like straights or anything really that good on the table, and it doesn't make sense that they picked up two of a kind suddenly because their betting just stays strong throughout. And then on the river, it turns out that a two flipped up and they were playing pocket twos the whole time. And I'm like, why are you still in? And they're like, oh, it's a pair. And you're like,
that paid off for you.
Yeah. I mean,
well, that's one of the problems especially with limit poker is that, of the invention and the misuse of what's called implied odds, because a lot of people who play poker you're calculating the really good poker players are calculating the odds of their hand winning, but then you bring in what's called implied odds, which get misused all the time, and that's the if my hand does win, not whether or not it's likely to win, but if my hand does win, how much money can I win with it? So basically, it's like, is this hand good enough that Aaron will think I have something horrible and he won't know what I have, and then I can convince him to bet more and more and more and then win on the end and win a lot of money rather than, you know, win a little bit of money with an actual good hand to get him to fold. It's really weird. The one thing, and I was wondering if you're going to bring this up. I do have a problem with Texas Hold'em, and that is it doesn't necessarily have player elimination, I guess, unless you run out of money. But I find when I play Texas Hold'em, most of the time I'm not playing Texas Hold'em. I'm just sitting there watching other people play Texas Hold'em.
I play very aggressively. So
you're the guy. You're the guy that you hate.
I know I'm not, but I will generally push people around in Texas Hold'em and just stay in and bet.
So you see a lot of flops.
I don't play. Yeah, I see a lot of flops. I don't play stupid because I paid my rent for 4 months playing Texas Hold'em. But I would play aggressively. I would play in a lot of bounty tournaments where you get bonuses for taking out other players, and that's kind of where I did very well is in that kind of thing, because I love, nothing is better than taking someone out of the game, unfortunately. Like when you run someone out and they go all in and you win that showdown, that's like the best part, the best feeling in Texas Hold'em.
All right, so maybe you already mentioned it, but just for clarity, what is the best mechanic about Texas Hold'em?
The best mechanic is the fact that you're only holding two cards, yet there's still like so much unsure about what you have. Mm-hmm. The fact that there is public information in that version of poker makes it, it's why it's considered the Cadillac of poker, because you're playing like with, I know he could have this many different hands, what are the odds of this? It even though it's giving you more information than simple stud would, it somehow makes the game more interesting because you're able to think about that information and what it implies he may have. In stud, you're literally just like, this is how good my hand is, you know, trying to read the person and be like, is it better than any one of the other hands that he could possibly have, which is a huge number. So
yeah, that's one of the things I like. That's one of the things I like, is that the Texas Hold'em, the flop comes out, the first thing you can do is be like, okay, so with this flop the best hand is pocket aces, followed by pocket eights, followed by pocket twos, followed by ace eight. You know, it's like you can go through the list and figure out where you stand. But of course, then you have to try to figure out where they're at.
So, yeah,
yeah. I think that makes sense. It's rare that it provides a much deeper experience because it does give you that little bit of information rather than going completely blind. But that's a good point, though.
What's weird is going into this episode, I was a little bit like, traditional games, you know, that's like a thing. I don't play them that much, but, you know, let's do our due diligence and do an episode and talk about them. But now the episode has actually served its purpose for me, because I'm like, I need to play more card games. I need to play bridge and cribbage and backgammon and learn these games. I should definitely be taking my own advice and putting them into my rotation more often.
Don't just tell it, live it.
So, my heart grew three sizes today.
Well, there you go. So hit us up on Twitter or through email. Let us know what your favorite traditional games are. We would love to hear sort of your region's favorite games. So maybe we can sort of start putting together the pieces of that map that we were talking about and trying to figure out, you know, what games are popular in what areas. Because I know, for example, in my school, I learned 13 when I was in middle school. It was very big at my middle school. And these guys who grew up, you know, not 30 miles away from me have never heard of it. So there you go. On that note, we will get to the what we are excited about portion of the show, and we will do that right now. On to the what we are excited about portion of the show, and we will start with Del. Del, what are you excited about this week?
I am excited about Hollywood. Hollywood has taken my favorite RPG property.
Wait, RPG no. property?
No, this is a remnants. He is taking our Facebook discussion onto the podcast. These are remnants of an argument that we've been in.
It was described. Fox has optioned to do a feature-length film about Magic: The Gathering, and it's interesting because the whole reason Planeswalkers exist is because Wizards was approached about a Magic movie about 10 years ago, and they said, we want to do a Magic movie, and the studio was like, great, what's your big character? And they're like, well, there's these two brothers who are hyper powerful godlike beings who had a war where one of them introduced the Phyrexians to the, and Hollywood was like, no, go away, make real identifiable characters that we can slap on lunchboxes and make action figures out of. And so Wizards invented the Planeswalker type and created Jace Balarin, the ultimate audience insert, to have something to be able to go to Hollywood and say, these are the characters that our game are about. Our game are about. And so that's why Jason and Johnny and Chandra exist. And I'm super interested because the D&D movie had some things wrong with it. But anything that gets more people buying packs of cards so that the shadowy cardboard cabals' values of their fetches and Tarmogoyfs goes up is good for me.
As a member of
yes,
that cabal.
As a member of that shadowy cabal, that's good for me. No, I like people who are excited to play Magic and getting more people into the hobby so it doesn't ossify into old grognards not being excited about the game anymore is good. And who knows, it might actually be fun if they make it about Jaya Ballard instead of Chandra.
I wish that it was the plot of this was from the Magic novel Arena and the story of like Garth One Eye, which looking back is a really like trashy, like super obvious like fiction thing, but when I read it as a kid, like my mind was blown by like the Shyamalan twist in it, and it was really awesome. And I'm thinking about it now, I'm like, I wish that was a movie. I would watch that Magic movie.
Best case scenario for the movie, Del,
case scenario is that the movie is set on Ravnica and follows Argus Koss as the Ravnica hardened grizzled John McClane cop and his comedic buddy Fibblethip. if it's Argus Koss and Fibblethip, I'm all the buys. I will buy 10 tickets.
What about Fibblethip CGI or?
I think you have to do puppets. I think you have to go puppet.
I think you have to go Muppets.
I see. I want the movie to be modern day Magic players get transported through another dimension
by riding a roller coaster. Perhaps.
Yeah, something like that. So yeah, and then
this
they
is
have
basically
to,
the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon from the 80s.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want it to end with like, well, you know, Del, the magic was in you all along. And then Del wakes up and then like he's like, oh my god, what day is it? And I'm like, dude, it's Sunday, come on, we gotta go, we're getting ready for the PTQ. And then like we're running out the door, and then you know he sees like a missive in the mail that's like stamped with like the Ravnica insignia or something, and then that's the end.
Yeah, the Demir Guild is the guild that does not exist. Calls me.
No, I mean, in all honesty, though, what I want to see is something that's set in the worlds that are one of the worlds that Wizards has created. But I don't want it. I do not want it to be sorcerers summoning creatures to fight each other. Like, I just want it to be a fantasy movie set in a cool world. And then in the background, I want guys to be playing Magic in a tavern.
That would be awesome. Can I go next?
Yeah. What are you excited about, Aaron?
So I'm excited about the most metal RPG setting I've ever heard of.
Go on.
This actually came out originally. There was a Kickstarter for a Fate mecha game called Apotheosis Drive X.
Okay.
And this was a stretch goal. It was like a small 5-page setting in the back of it. And now it's being made into a full Fate core game. And that's Iron Edda. And in Iron Edda, it is a Norse mecha game in that you play Vikings who bond themselves to the skeletons of giants and then use them to beat up, like, dwarven golems.
I don't want the Magic movie anymore. I want this.
The art is really cool. It's so awesome and so off of the wall.
Iron Edda. How do you spell that?
It's I-R-O-N and then E-D-D-A.
E-D-D-A. Okay, go on.
It's just amazing. Like, it's super cool. It has the image of, like a Viking guy, like, floating in, like, like under the rib cage of a giant that's holding two axes, and it's super awesome.
There's another Kickstarter called Iron Edda.
What, really?
Yeah, because this one is like already done. And it's a novel.
Oh yeah, that's he wrote a novel in this world before he did the game.
Oh, yeah, so we're talking about Iron Edda: War of Metal and Bone.
Yes,
gotcha. That looks a lot more conducive to what we were talking about.
Yeah, not the story he wrote, but this game, and uses Fate, which obviously we are fans of here.
Sure.
I'm pretty excited. It's made by Tracy Barnett, who also did a really cool RPG called School Days. That's kind of an indie style RPG about high school. Mm-hmm. So I'm pretty excited about it. It looks awesome.
Yeah, it looks pretty sweet. I'm looking at some of the concept art, I think, here. Looks rad. That does look pretty metal.
I can't wait to hang out somewhere, like, at one of our houses, playing this game, bumping, like, Blind Guardian in the background, like, as the music. So, it's going to be awesome.
Very, very cool. I am also excited about a Kickstarter. A listener of the show actually tweeted it at us, BalrogHunter_76, and it is called Hero Forge. It is customizable 3D printed tabletop miniatures. And now, we talked a lot about this sort of off the air before, in that we're kind of waiting for the 3D printing technology to kind of hit the tabletop and see what it's going to do. And this looks absolutely awesome. Now, there is a small caveat to it, and that caveat being that the individual figures are a little bit expensive, but it's a new technology, and you know, you want to be on the cutting edge. You're going to pay the cutting edge prices, I suppose. But it's super awesome, and it's literally like the dream of people like me who like playing RPGs with miniatures. We talked about it on the show during our So You Want to Get Into episode for RPGs, and that even in games that aren't necessarily tactical, I like to have a representation of my character in the corner of the scene there. It just helps me visualize things. And with this project, you're going to be able to hand pick elements to make your miniature completely 100% unique. So if you couldn't find a halfling with a broad axe wearing chainmail, now you can do that. You can go to their little app and you can go halfling, broad axe, chainmail, mohawk, whatever. And then you can kind of make the mini. So there's going to be a variety of poses, a variety of weapons, races, clothing types. And if you go to the Kickstarter, like I said, we'll list it in the show notes. Under the Kickstarter's name, it is just called Customizable 3D Printed Tabletop Miniatures by Hero Forge. So if you have to search for it without the help of the show notes, you can go there. But it looks pretty awesome. There's a couple tiers for what you can back it at. The basic customized figure is going to run you about $30. Which is expensive for a miniature, but if you've been playing in a campaign for a while and haven't been able to find that one mini that sort of is exactly what you want, this might be a way to do that, and that's pretty sweet. Have any of you guys taken a look at this Kickstarter?
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. It looks like at the beginning there's a like a Hero Machine tool where you can kind of throw your dude together with a bunch of customizable bits in their 3D... 3D kind of machine.
Yeah, basically what it is it comes, it's a web-based
yes.
service. So like the UI is going to be on the web, and I think they're still in development with it. It might not, I think if you kickstart it, you can get access to the beta when it goes live. But the idea would be that it'd be a very intuitive 3D sort of, I don't even know what to say, like Illustrator, I guess, where you can go in and kind of play around with the different options and see what they would look like and see what he looks like in this pose with a halberd or that pose with a halberd. And then when, you know, once you finalize it, then they'll 3D print it up for you. They're raising the money right now because they have to, obviously they have a lot of artwork, a lot of pre sort of production that they need to make, because it's, as you can imagine, it's not that easy to come up with, like, you know, all these different types of sculpts. I mean, they have to basically sculpt every piece digitally before they actually make the molds of it. And they have to do it in a way where it's interchangeable. So if someone wants an elf wearing chainmail with a hood holding a sword, they can get that. But if someone wants an elf wearing chainmail with a hood holding a spear, they can get that as well. So it looks neat. And like I said, it's a little bit pricey, but it's what you're going to pay for when you're, you know, like I said, on the cutting edge of technology, and hopefully moving forward, we'll see more of these types of things at maybe more reasonable rates. But if you have to have your mini just the way you want it, look into this Kickstarter because it's pretty sweet.
I might do that so I can get a Presto the Elf.
Oh, man. If only we were ever going to play with him again, that would be awesome.
Be pretty great. I miss that guy.
I just want to say, like, whenever I see these cool minis Kickstarters, the game designer in me is immediately like, I want to design a game based around this. And this one was even more so, because the idea of a mini game that's based more around how you equip your guy, and that's represented on the mini, than which guys you use, is very interesting to me. The problem being that even if it was like a 5-on-5 skirmish game, you're paying like $150 for your faction or whatever. Obviously, like, kind of a limit. So I'm toying with whether I want to back this one and at least get one cool figure.
If you're seriously thinking about backing it, there's a $100 level that gets you 6 minis for $100, which is like $18 a piece. So if you're serious, let's talk on Twitter later and see if we want to do this.
I might not even need a mini, because I'm one of those people who can go into like the character creation screen of a role-playing game and just sit there for like hours just customizing, moving all the little dials back and forth. So I might just like pledge enough for me to actually just check out the character builder, because I think that'd be awesome and I want to get in that beta and sort of play around with the bits and bobbles, and then eventually I'm probably sure I'll make something that I need to have a physical version of and then end up paying, you know, tons of money for it. So there you go. That is what we are excited about for this week. Now, if you have been listening on iTunes, first of all, thank you very much. We appreciate all of our listeners. And you can, of course, subscribe to the show on iTunes. It helps us out. It helps out with some iTunes metric type stuff that I'm sure people get paid a lot of money to look at. So that's always a plus. Of course, you can give us a review as well. As you know, if it's a 5-star review, Dell will read it on the air in a voice of your choice. He loves voices. He loves choices. He loves rhymes. All the times. If you have been listening on Stitcher Radio, like NPC Aaron does, you can, of course, give us a thumbs up. You can use the plus button to add us to your favorites or something. There's stars sometimes. All sorts of cool buttons on Stitcher that help us out. There's reviews on Stitcher as well. We appreciate that because, as you guys know, Stitcher is like the Pandora of podcasts. So we want people who are listening to other RPG or games podcasts to get recommended us, and we want people who are listening to us to get recommended other RPG and tabletop games podcasts. And that can only happen if you guys are plussing and thumbs upping and starring our show. So that's greatly appreciated as well. However, there is one thing, and really it's the only thing, that we actually actively ask you to do. And that is what, Aaron?
That is to tell your friends, whether in real life or on social media. And we want to clarify, even though we have Patreon now, this is still like the most important thing you could do to help us.
Oh, yeah. If the decision is you donate a dollar or $10 a month for content versus you telling a friend or 10 friends a month about our show, we'll take the you telling your friends option 10 times out of 10. That is what is matters most to us, is just getting the word of mouth going, and because we think that we're doing a good thing for gamers and we want more gamers to experience that. So you can help out by telling your friends about us. That helps out so much. Does anyone else have anything else to add?
Go Hawks.
Oh man. I'm nervous. I think we're gonna win. We're Hawks fans. I think we're gonna win, but you're always nervous, you know. It's gonna be a great game, I'm sure. On that note, you can add 1000 XP to your character sheets, and we will see you next time. Bye-bye. NPC Cast is written by Chris, Dell, and Aaron. You can reach us on Twitter at twitter.com/NPCcast or by email at thenpccast@gmail.com. As always, support your local game store.